After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
So radical love and forgiveness are very complementary. Without forgiveness, you cannot practice radical love. And so Jain tradition is a tradition of forgiveness.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu back with Mind Rolling, and I am with Satish Kumar. Satish, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Satish, just to give a little bit of an idea, has done many, many things in his life, and from peace walks in your youth in the 60s in India to the nuclear capitals of the world, Moscow, Paris, London, Washington, and establishing a school in England where he lives and speaking so much about what this central topic is of this wonderful book. Here it is, Radical Love, speaking so much about love and how to transform our separation into connectivity with everything. And I can't wait to hear your story because I know it's profound. And can you start at the very, very beginning? Where did you grow up in India, and what were your circumstances?
It is my pleasure to be with you, Raghu, and be interviewed by you. I was born in Rajasthan in India in 1936. In a Jain family. And my mother was a wonderful Jain woman, and she practiced tremendous amount of meditation and gardening and good cooking and a very spiritual person. And so I grew up in Rajasthan in northwest India.
And what were your proclivities that led you to the work you have been doing and led you, I mean, growing up in an Indian family, I full well understand that you, the opening that you had to you, the spiritual reality of who we really are was, say, a little less encumbered with what we encounter in the West. And I think you full well know that, being that you live here now. I stumbled along myself for quite a while in my teenage years. And then finally in my early 20s, I met Ram Dass, who I know you know who that is.
Yes, yes. And I met him.
Yes, that's right. We'll get that from you later. But what was the transformational qualities of what happened to you in your formative years to lead you to where you are now?
Experience. Yes, I mean, one of the great influence on my life was Mahatma Gandhi.
Mm.
And yeah. And the idea of radical love, in a way, starts with Mahatma Gandhi. And Mahatma Gandhi fought with the British with nonviolence and love. He says that it is no good loving only your friends. It's not enough to love your family and your colleagues. Not enough to love somebody you like and you agree. But British, they are my friends. They are my brothers and sisters. And I want to love them. And I do love them. Because I want to say to them that being imperialist and colonialist is not good for you and not good for India. And therefore, we are not against you, we are against colonialism, imperialism, exploitation, and so on. Mm. So that was the most great influence in my life and on my life from Mahatma Gandhi. And ever since, all the activities I have done, like you mentioned, going around the world and so on, they have all come from that principle that we need to love people with whom we don't agree. Because the transformation is an alchemy of love that we have to practice to transform humans into friends, transform enemies into friends, transport opponents into friends. And that was the great influence of my... I was 18 years old when I first read Mahatma Gandhi's book, his autobiography, My Experiment with Truth, in Hindi. And reading that book really changed my life. And ever since, I have felt that Mahatma Gandhi is the hero of my life.
Mm. Yeah, Ram Dass refers to it in a very similar way for him. Yeah. My life is my message, he used to quote all the time.
That's right, that's right. Yeah. Mahatma Gandhi always said that words are not enough. Words represent something deeper and more profound. And that is your practice, how you live. Not you talk about love, you think about love, but you practice love. And for Mahatma Gandhi, religion was not in a temple. Religion was not in a book like the Quran or the Bhagavad Gita or the Bible. Mm. Religion is not in somewhere else. Religion is in your daily practice of love. And that is what influenced and inspired me to practice that love and write this radical book, a radical love book.
It is a radical book.
Yeah. Yes.
So one other thing that I understand from getting to know you through the magic of the digital age is how important your mother was. And you know, because you met many teachers and gurus and celebrities and so on and so forth, but none compared, you said, to your mother. And I will say, I don't know if you ever heard this from the Dalai Lama, but the Dalai Lama says, and he says it quite often these days, the key to the transformation of us going into the future, which gives me tremendous hope, is our mothers. He said, you see me as I am, you know, a compassionate being, and I tell you that came from my mother, who was an extraordinarily compassionate woman. And when we have that proliferating, he didn't say it exactly like that, but we are talking about the potential of those that grow up with that kind of compassionate affection, connection, love, that will be able to change this world, change people's hearts from separation to connection. So, talk about your own mother and your experience that way.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Mahatma Gandhi was an influence on me more on an intellectual level because I never met him. I only read his books and I met some of his followers and some of his friends. But my mother's influence was more personal. And she was my hero. I would say every mother is a hero because a mother brings you in the world. Mother carries you for 9 months. My mother carried me in her womb for 9 months. And a life and death experience that she goes through when she gave me the birth. Mm. And then she fed me with her own body, the breastfeeding, and looked after me as I grew up. And so that those formative years, and through her breast and the milk from the breast, and through her food, and through her talking and walking with her, my mother was a naturalist. She will walk from house to garden, which was a little further away. And she will hold my hand and she will say, it is better to walk and learn from nature. Nature is our teacher. And say, how? Mother, tell me, how is nature teacher? So she will give me one example. She will say, Look at the honeybee. Honeybee goes from flower to flower, never harms any flower, and only takes a little nectar from this flower, little nectar from that flower, a little nectar from that flower, gathers a little nectar from many flowers. Never, ever a flower has complained that honeybee took too much nectar away and harmed me. Never harms a flower.
Mm.
That is how we should learn. We should take from nature only little to meet our needs and never damage nature, never damage trees, never damage animals, never damage soil. This is what we should learn from nature. Mm. So my mother gave me the first lesson to learn from nature and respect nature and see how nature is so benign and so caring and so looking after everybody. So that was the kind of teaching of my mother, which I got. And that made me eventually an ecologist, because my mother was a kind of ecologist or naturalist. Mm. So that was a great influence of my mother on my life.
You are very fortunate, Satishji. Very. You know, many of us in the West grow up in very uncertain circumstances and really deal with a lot of, shall we say, counterintuitive processes that really people have to unravel in their for the rest of their lives in terms of the kind of psychological stuff and neurotic tendencies and habitual patterns that everybody is faced with. But without that solidity that you had of a mother like you had or like His Holiness had, there's a little bit of, oh boy, wish we were, a little bit more fortunate. You know, I am still, after decades, you know, going to India with Ram Dass to meet Neem Karoli Baba back in the day. Okay, from that time on, and I was like 20-odd years old at that time, from that time to now, I am still working with whatever patterns that were handed to me, not just by parental, but society. It was very difficult here in the West, but I'm not complaining.
Raghu, when you went to see Neem Karoli Baba,
yeah,
many of our teachers, many of our gurus have a kind of mother quality. Mm. If you take Ramana Maharshi, if you take Ramakrishna Paramhansa, if you take Vivekananda, you take even Mahatma Gandhi, they had a very feminine, motherly quality.
Yes.
And so nurturing, caring, taking care of your disciples, your friends, your followers, and giving them love. That's a kind of feminine mother quality. So my other teacher was Vinoba. Now, you know what Vinoba's name means? His name was Vinu, and the Ba was added to the name. And Ba means mother. So this man, who was a follower of Mahatma Gandhi, was called Mother Vinu, Vinoba. Mm,
really?
So even men can have a motherhood quality. So Neem Karoli Baba had that quality. And when Ram Dass met Neem Karoli Baba, and so feeding the people, taking care of the people like mothers do. So he had that motherhood quality. So motherhood quality is not necessarily gender related. It's a heart related. It's a spirit related.
Mm.
And many of our gurus have that mother quality. And therefore, I would say the mother principle of India, from which we get Durga and Saraswati and Kali and Mahalakshmi, all these feminine qualities, and a Sita with Rama and a Radha with Krishna. So I think we need to embrace this feminine quality even among men. So it's not a gender question. It's more a question of spirit.
Ah, so true. Oh, love that. So one other thing that was influential, I do know, for you was you joined the Jain order, right? You became a monk. Tell us about that.
Yes. I mean, the Jain tradition is very similar to Buddhist tradition.
Mm.
And I was a young boy, and My father died when I was only 4 years old.
Oh, I didn't know.
And so I was wondering, oh, I lost my father, and my mother is crying, and my sisters are crying, and my brothers are crying, and neighbors are crying, and everybody's sad. Death must be very bad. And so I went to one of my gurus, Jain Guru, and I asked him, please tell me, is there a way to stop people dying? And he said, there's only one way to stop the cycle of birth and death. And that is to renounce the world and become a monk. And I said, I will do anything to stop the cycle of birth and death, because death is so painful and people become so sad and they cry and they go into mourning and all that. So eventually, because inspired by that, I became a Jain monk. And I was very fortunate because my mother gave me the blessing, because she did not want me to not be a monk, because she thought it's a great spiritual path. Although she also had a feeling that she will lose me and not have my company. But at the same time, she did not want to be an obstacle on my spiritual search and spiritual seeking. And therefore, she allowed me. And so I became a Jain monk. And a Jain monk is a very strong path of love. I would say I have followed the path of love. The influence on my life has been the influence of love. First of all, from my mother. And then, as I mentioned, Mahatma Gandhi eventually. But in between, the Jain Guru. The Jains say, before you go to bed, every night, you have to say one mantra. And that mantra is, Khame mi sabva jive, sabve jiva khamantume, mitti me sabva bhuesu, veram majjat nake nahi. Which means, I forgive all living beings if anyone has hurt me or harmed me or upset me. Secondly, if anyone has hurt me and harmed me, I forgive them. So first, I ask their forgiveness. And second, I give forgiveness to them. And then you say that all living beings upon this earth, humans and other than humans, are all my friends. And the fourth line you say, and I have no enemies. No enemies, no adversaries. Everybody's my friend. Now that is, Raghu, a wonderful teaching of Jain tradition.
Mm.
And every night, this was a kind of a rule which I embodied and taken into my heart to say this mantra before going to bed, that I take no animosity, I carry no anger, I carry no jealousy, I carry no revenge. Anybody who has done anything harm to me, I forgive. So forgiveness was the highest principle. And our Jain teaching was said that forgiveness is the arms and the kind of dress of the brave and the courageous. Only the brave and the courageous are able to forgive. And the weak and the coward carry the revenge and take the revenge and harm other people. Mm. So that was a Jain tradition. And I lived the Jain monk's life for 9 years, from age 9 to 18,
really?
Before I joined the Gandhian movement. And so that was a great and profound teaching from my early age of forgiveness. So radical love and forgiveness are very complementary. Without forgiveness, you cannot practice radical love. And so Jain tradition is a tradition of forgiveness.
Mm. Yeah. Wow. You know, you also say, there's something that you're known for saying, my nature is to let things happen rather than make them happen. And I guess the question is, and it's, you know, I saw this in an interview you did, but the question is, how do you connect that to the reality of popping around the world, you know, working for nuclear disarmament, etc., you know, being an activist How does that jive with letting things happen rather than make them happen? And what do you really mean?
Yes, yes. I mean, there is a kind of psychological state. In a psychological state, you offer your service, you offer your action as a gift to the world. And that is how you let things happen. You let your heart come out and you follow your heart. And you, I mean, I would say that I allowed myself to let go to Moscow, Paris, London, Washington. 8,000 miles I walked. And I walked without any penny in my pocket. Not a single dollar, not a single euro, not a single rupee. Without any money, for 2.5 years, I walked through Pakistan, Afghanistan, the mountains, the deserts of Iran, Soviet Union, Europe, America, Japan, 15 countries. But I just let it happen. I was not making any big effort. Although, of course, you are walking. It's a bit of effort.
Yeah,
but psychologically, Raghu, is it different. It's physical effort was there, of course. You cannot deny that. But psychologically, I was just letting it happen. I was not forcing anything. I was not imposing anything. I was just following my heart and let my body go and my mind follow the body and the body follow the mind. And that is the way I understand and I interpret and I live my life. To say, let things happen. Even this interview, I'm not making any great effort. I'm letting it happen. You invited me and I said, yes. So I say, yes. So it's a kind of state of mind. It's a psychological state in which you let things happen because something is bound to happen. You cannot be standing still. So action is natural. But desires, expectations, these are the things which make you do things. And therefore, if you reduce your expectations, you reduce your desires, you reduce your attachment, and then just do what naturally comes to you, and you do it very lightly and without feeling any burden. This is what I did in my journey around the world for 2.5 years. I let it happen. And there's not only that journey, but now I'm 87 years old. And most of my life has been like that. I just let things happen.
Oh, just let me say to you, boy, do you look fantastic. 87 years old. My God, you're you're a model for sure. Look at you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Amazing, amazing. In relation to the kind of work that you've done for peace, for nuclear disarmament, and there's so many issues now that are so extraordinarily important, mostly around, of course, the environment. What about karma? The reality of what we have created, we are now having to live with in a way that can be very disconcerting. And when you see the immense rush to nationalism and power and money and really tremendous ignorance, shall we say. And, you know, this is not just happening ad hoc. I mean, there is a collective karma, I believe, to this. How do you respond to that?
I mean, that collective karma is a karma of pursuit of material comfort and material wealth rather than a spiritual wealth and spiritual seeking. And therefore, for the last few hundred years, the Western civilization in particular, and Western civilization has been influencing the rest of the civilizations in Africa, in Asia, like countries like China and India and Japan, since the Second World War. We have been forcing, persuading, informing, and a kind of encouraging entire world to go materialist, to go consumerist, to pursue the industrial way of life, industrial farming, industrial production, consumption. And that karma is coming back into many forms. And one of the big karma, consequence of our industrialism, materialism, consumerism, is global warming and climate change. And the other consequence is destruction of biodiversity and the destruction of a rainforest and the pollution of our oceans and pollution of our rivers and the pollution of our soil and land. And that's a kind of collective karma of our world, which is the consequence of this materialistic, industrial and consumerist society and civilization that we have built over the last 200 years. And the other thing we have built is the militarism. And that is also collective karma. And that militarism has resulted into wars after wars after wars, in which millions and millions of people are killed and get killed, and destruction. The First World War, the Second World War, the Vietnam War, the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, the Ukraine War, the Gaza War, and the list goes on. So these are the kind of collective karma. So what we need to do as a humanity is to wake up to the teachings of Ram Dass, and wake up to the teachings of Neem Karoli Baba or Ramana Maharshi or Vivekananda or Mahatma Gandhi, and say we need to let things happen in a very natural way, and not this pursuit of higher and higher and higher material growth and economic growth and material possessions and more comfortable life and more wasteful life. So elegant simplicity and a living frugal life is a kind of a spiritual teachings of Mahatma Gandhi and many, many other Western Christian teachers like St. Francis. He taught the way of living simply and more elegantly and not wastefully. So I think our karma, collective karma, is a kind of bringing negative results and bringing destruction and a threat the kind of end of civilization. And therefore, we need to wake up and we need to say, how can we live in harmony with natural world? How can we make peace with nature? At the moment, we are acting against nature by keeping millions of animals into factory farms in a very cruel conditions and destroying our rainforest in Amazon and many other countries and polluting our rivers and oceans and our soil and also degrading humans and turning the humans into refugees and killing them in wars for in their hundreds of thousands. So all these things are not going to be cost-free. They will have a consequence. Every action has a consequence. And that's the karma. Every action has a reaction, a consequence. So if people think that I can do what I like and has no consequence, I can pollute the rivers, I can pollute the oceans, I can pollute the soil, I can destroy the rainforest, I can go to war, and there'll be no consequence. There's no such thing. There's no free lunch. So there's no consequence. There's no action without consequence, without result. So karma is coming back to us with global warming, climate change, and many, many other problems. Yes. And so I would like to urge people to wake up to spiritual values and a more ethical values and moral values, and say how we can live in harmony with ourselves. How can we live in harmony with all people, whatever their nationality, whatever their religion? They are all humans. One humanity, the unity of humanity, that has to be recognized. We want to have a good karma. And the moment you recognize the unity of humanity, then you say, whole cosmos is my country. Whole planet Earth is my home. Nature is my nationality. And love is my religion. The moment you realize that kind of cosmic mind and cosmic consciousness, then you can create a good karma, and that will result into more peaceful world and a peaceful relationship with the natural world. And also love yourself and a respect for yourself, you will be more happy. That is the way I will suggest to reverse the karmic consequences that we are facing today in terms of global warming, climate change, wars in Gaza, wars in Ukraine, and so many other problems that we face today in the world.
Yeah. You know what I love, Satishji? I love that analogy earlier in this conversation of the bees, right? They only take as much as they need without harming anything. That's a beautiful, beautiful analogy for what we do, which is the opposite, raping everything to get absolutely without any regard to, as you just said, the consequences. That's such a beautiful thing.
I mean, you know, when a doctor starts the practice to be a doctor, the first oath they take is called Hippocratic Oath. And that Hippocratic Oath is, first, do no harm. Mm. Do no harm to yourself, do no harm to other people, and do no harm to nature. That is the Hippocratic Oath a doctor takes. I would like to suggest, Raghu, that everybody should take that. Politicians should take that. Scientists should take that. Mm-hmm. Economists should take that. Business and industrial leaders should take that. Do no harm. If you do no harm to yourself, and you do no harm to other people, and you do no harm to nature, then you can have a more positive karma. And the consequence will be a more harmonious relationship and a more peaceful world and a better relationship among all humans, whether you are a Muslim or a Christian or a Jew or a Hindu or a Buddhist, you are American, a Russian, a Chinese, a Israelis, a Palestinian, Ukrainian, whoever you are, we are all human beings. And our first and prime duty is to do no harm to other people. Before I'm an Indian, I'm a human being. Before I'm a Hindu, I'm a human being. If I went around the world as an Indian, I'd meet a Pakistani or a Russian or an American. If I go as a Hindu, I'd meet a Muslim or a Christian or a Jew or a Buddhist. But if I go as a human being, I'd meet a human being everywhere, whether you are in Russia or America or Japan or Afghanistan or Iran. So if we start with being human, and then no problem in being an Indian or Chinese or Russian or American or European, no harm. If you are a human being with that big cosmic mind, when I say cosmos is my country, then I can have India as my country as well, no problem. When I say whole planet Earth is my home, then I can have Rajasthan as my home, no problem. When I say nature is my nationality, then I can say India is also my nationality, no problem. If I say love is my religion, then I can say Hindu or Buddhist or Muslim is my religion as well. So that you can have best of both worlds. But if you just say only I'm an Indian and I will kill other people in the name of India, or I kill other people in the name of Hindu or Muslim or Jew or some other religion, then I think we are becoming too narrow. So I would like our karmic consequence is to start with a cosmic mind, a bigger mind, and then the intimate love and the ultimate love live in harmony together. Mm. So love your country, love your home, love your community, love your nationality, love your religion, but love that within the context of the bigger love, which is cosmic love. Then there's no harm in being a Hindu or American or Buddhist or Russian or whatever. So this is the kind of balance between the two.
Mm. You know, I don't think this is something you're unaware of course, but I remember once we were at a retreat with Ram Dass and one of our close teachers, her name is Sharon Salzberg, Buddhist, and we were talking about Ram Dass had come up with this beautiful practice around loving awareness, like moving out of your story and your mind and your attachment to all of that into the center of your being, into that place where there's no judgments on yourself or anybody, and just breathing in loving awareness, a beautiful practice.
Yeah.
We were talking about it and Sharon said, he's talking about love.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, love is not weak. People think that when, you know, I've had an experience in talking about love, especially as a Buddhist, And they, you know, everyone squirms a little bit. First of all, our concept of love, especially in the West, is give and take. It has nothing to do with it's conditional, not the unconditionality, of course, that we experienced, particularly with Neem Karoli Baba. There was no polarization of anything whatsoever. There was all of us in that one place of love. And so love is a tough word because of our associations with it. And many people do believe, well, I got to be careful. Can't be going too far into love because I don't want to be appearing weak. So, you know, I just want to read something from the book. Actually, it's the first couple of paragraphs. We'll just read one.
Yes.
And you talk, here it is. Gravity and love are two aspects of a single reality. I've never heard it put quite this way, Satya. They are the organizing principles of our precious planet and our amazing universe. Gravity holds dominion over the physical, our outer world. Love holds dominion over the metaphysical, our inner world. Gravity sustains our material existence, while love nourishes our spiritual existence. Gravity is to the body what love is to the heart, soul, and consciousness. Gravity relates to what can be measured, while love relates to what can be imagined. Gravity sustains matter. Love gives it meaning. In the end, everything is held together by love. I mean, that's a beautiful expression of really, it's core to what this whole book is about, really.
And, that's right.
So
that's
it'd be right. Great. Yeah, talk about the what you're speaking to here, the combination of gravity and love and what that really means in practice.
Yes, as scientists have understood, but how everything is held together. What is the principle that Earth holds us together and all life is held together physically? And scientists have come up with such marvelous theory of gravity. And I think that's a very wonderful theory. But they have forgotten that there is another reality which holds us together. Scientists don't quite kind of have a courage to understand the non-physical reality. And of course, there are wonderful scientists like James Lovelock and Pritchard Kapra and Vandana Shiva and many other of that kind who have understood this. So I'm trying to say that as gravity holds the material world together, love holds the non-material, metaphysical, spiritual world together. All our relationships, whether they are mother and father and a child, or brother and a sister, or a neighbor and neighbor, or whatever relationship there are, they are all held with love, with respect to each other, with recognition that the other person is sacred, other person is holy, other person has a soul, other person has consciousness, other person has imagination. This recognition holds our nations together, our communities together, our castes together, our communities together. So I think love is as powerful force as gravity. This is what I believe. And we, the scientists and the industrialists and the business people and the politicians, need to learn that. Because at the moment, why we have all these wars and conflicts and destruction and death? Because we have forgotten that we are held together with love. We think we can hold together by NATO or by some military power or some European Union type of political association or some kind of national combination. All those are okay. They are external. They are more like gravity. But there's a beyond that. And that is respect for each other and respect for diversity of views. Like you have biodiversity, you have a cultural diversity, you have a linguistic diversity, you have a religious diversity, you have truth diversity. So recognizing that diversity and respecting that and loving the diversity and not turning everything into uniformity and saying everything should be same and everything should be like American or everything should be industrial or everything should be a business and everything should be free market. All that kind of monotonous uniformity destroys the love. Love embraces diversity. Every human being is different. Every human being has a unique quality. So every human being is a special gift to this world. And we should respect that every human being, like we respect every tree, every animal, every bird, different. And that's the kind of principle of love that I say equal to gravity.
Mm. Okay, now I'm going to do a little what we call in America pushback, which means... Okay. I am sure there are people who are listening to this, who will be listening to this, and just saying, well, first of all, I understand the love that we're speaking to, that you are speaking to, is not conditional love. We are not talking about conditional love like that which might take place, say, in a marriage, where, you know, people go astray because they don't feel like they're being responded to in the way that they want to be. And so it's conditional. There's a great story, by the way, I'll tell you just for a sec. We were with Neem Karoli Baba, and we were young Westerners, and we were creating relationships within our group and so on and so forth. And somebody... you know, was with another, a man and a woman got together, a young man and a young woman. And we had a great mentor. His name was Datta Mukherjee, who wrote the wonderful book, By His Grace, which really says more about the nature of Neem Karoli Baba than any other book. Anyhow, we were at his house and he said, you know, and he named the people, I won't name them, that had the man had come by. He was completely in tears that they had broken up or something for a minute, had a fight, whatever it was. And Dada said, you know, he comforted him. And then he said to us later, can you imagine? He's crying over this love, which is really more about a business. You do what I want and I'm happy. I do what you want, you're happy. It's conditional. He's with Neem Karoli Baba, Maharaji we used to call him, you know, where there is no conditions whatsoever. and, you know, he was pointing to the reality of the difference of unconditional love, which is what you're speaking to, and conditional love. But I will still say, even in that on that basis, that people are going to react and say, my God, look at the people in power that are creating this misery across this world, in Africa, in of course the Middle East, and of course in Eastern Europe, and other places as well, you know, Burma. And I mean, we could go on and on. The list is, these people are creating. Do we really think that there's a way in which through any kind of action that we can oppose the kinds of ignorance that we're talking about?
Yes, absolutely. Unconditional love is also unilateral love. Unilateral love means I don't wait to love you until you love me. I take the first step. Like when I was walking around the world, I was advocating unilateral disarmament. Mm. And I said, Russia, don't wait until America disarms. You show the first. You take the first step. So unconditional love is unilateral love. You take the first step. I love you. Whatever is your response, I love you. Unconditionally. No ifs, no buts, no acceptance. No acceptations, not expectations, just I love. That requires a lot of courage. You have to be very brave because love is not for the faint heart, particularly unconditional love, particularly unilateral love is not for the faint heart. It has to be for the courageous. And we all have courage. And the word ka comes from heart. We all have a heart. But we don't cultivate our heart. We just focus in our universities and schools, training the left brain, only the left brain and nothing else. Whereas if we were encouraged by our education and by our society to cultivate our heart, then we will be more courageous. And so I would say unconditional love. Love has to be unconditional. The moment you say, I love you only if you love me, only if you are good to me, then that's not love. That's a bargain. That's a kind of that's a kind of business deal.
Yeah.
You love me, I love you. So marriage is a kind of business deal. But if I love you unconditionally and unilaterally, no ups, no buts, no exceptions, and I expect you as you are, the moment you accept the other person as the other person is, then other person is different. Other person is special. Other person is unique. Other person is holy. Other person is a divine being. All those qualities will manifest the moment you offer your unconditional and unilateral love. So radical love is that. The modest love is love with expectation. Modest love is to love somebody you like, you agree, your friends, your colleagues, your family, your brothers, sisters, etc. But radical love is to love unconditionally, unilaterally, without expectations, and without thinking that I will love you only if you agree with me. If you disagree with me, I will not love you or I'll kill you. So unconditional and unilateral are the most important words in the kind of concept of radical love.
Yeah. Well, getting down to, here's another story of Ram Dass, actually, who used to put on his altar, on his puja table, pictures of various people, politicians for the most part, people in power. And he would say, you know, and he had Trump up there, and you know, when he was still alive. And he would say, I am relating with the soul of this being, not the incarnation. And he would say, I would say to that person, I am sorry for you having such a very rough incarnation in terms of what you manifest and what happened to you. And he did this for like decades. I mean, just working one-on-one and relating with the soul rather than the manifestation of the incarnation. And I have to say to you honestly, in my own case, and I said it to Ram Dass, I cannot do that. I cannot stand even looking at that picture. I feel, you know, as somebody who's just mean-spirited, you know, just on that level, never mind all the other political consequences or any of that. I'm from Canada, so I have a whole different view. I did not grow up in the U.S., and so my viewpoint is a little bit different, probably a little bit more hewed towards, you know, you eventually settling in Britain. But, yeah, I am.
Ram Dass was like natural elements.
He was what? Say that again.
Like water. Water does not say that I will quench the thirst of only the good people. Water will quench the thirst of a king or a beggar, a saint or a sinner, a priest or a prisoner, a human or animal or bird or plant. All living beings are sustained and nourished by water. Without any discrimination. There's no judgment, no segregation. Every living being is sustained and their thirst is quenched by water. Ram Dass was like water. He will not discriminate against Trump or Putin or anybody else. Everybody can nourish with his love and from his love. And therefore, he was like a natural element. I met Ram Dass in Omega Institute. And I was so inspired by him. He was like elements. He did not discriminate or judge or criticize or complain or just sit in judgment. He said, I will try to help everybody without exception. That was his generosity of spirit. That was the largeness of the heart. And he was a supreme example of radical love.
Mm. Well, you know, Neem Karoli Baba, what his instructions to Ram Dass were.
Yes.
Love everyone and tell the truth. And at that time, Ram Dass said, well, if I tell the truth, I can't love everyone. And Maharaji just looked at him again and he pointed his feet to go up, love everyone and tell the truth. And that's what his work was in the lifetime that he had. And let me tell you, I've never seen anybody approach even that reality of complete attention that he would give to people and just be there.
But you know, Raghu, in the Jain tradition, we say the love comes before truth.
Mm.
Truth, each and everyone has their own truth. We cannot determine what is absolutely final truth. We are all seeking truth. We are searching for truth. We are grappling with truth. And everybody has their own truth. But before truth, this is very important, comes love. And so you can, and the more important thing is to speak truth, but speak it with loving words. We say in Sanskrit, satyam bruyat, priyam bruyat, ma bruyat, satyam apriyam. Speak the truth, but speak it with love. And if you cannot speak it with love, then hold back and practice golden silence. Mm. Practicing golden silence with love is higher than speaking the truth harshly and uncomfortably, which hurts somebody's heart. So you have to develop the skills of speaking the truth with love so that people can be transformed by your truth and not be put off by your
polarized
truth.
Yeah.
Polarized. So love comes before truth.
Yeah. In the short time we have left, I do think there's, you know, you bring up Gandhi's a concept of sarvodaya. I'd like you to explain that. I think it's ultimately, it's the core of everything you're speaking to, would you?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. That was one of the great gifts of Mahatma Gandhi. He said that I want a new political, social, and spiritual paradigm. And that new social, political, and spiritual paradigm would be of sarvodaya, which means upliftment of every living being without any exception. So it is not a philosophy for the communist or the capitalist or the individual or the community or one section or the other section or majority or minority, but every single living being should be taken care of. And that every single living being, sarva means all, without exception. And udaya means upliftment or well-being of all. So that includes all living beings, means rich, poor, upper caste, lower caste, whoever you are. But not only humans, but also animals and the forest and the rivers and all the elements. That is a most beautiful, most comprehensive, most inclusive political and social and spiritual philosophy that you can imagine, sarvodaya. Mm. That is what Mahatma Gandhi wanted. He did not want to be a socialist or communist or capitalist or any one ist. He said that I do not want to leave any ism behind me because ism separates. Either you say I'm Buddhism means Buddhism separate from other isms, or I'm a communist, or communism separate from other isms, or capitalism separate from other isms. So isms separate. So let all isms become wasms, the past, and live a life which includes everybody, all human beings and all living beings, more than human beings. And that was a most visionary and far-reaching philosophy that Mahatma Gandhi came up with. And I think the modern day ecological philosophy, environmental philosophy, is very close to Mahatma Gandhi's idea of sarvodaya. And many, many great teachers and environmentalists have embraced that idea that we our worldview should not be just human-centered or anthropocentric. We should have a biocentric or life-centric or nature-centric. And we are all nature. Nature is not only animals and forests and rivers and mountains and oceans. Humans are also nature. We are all nature. And we are all made of nature. We are all made of earth, air, fire, water, and elements, four elements. And we are also all conscious. So nature is conscious. Earth is conscious. Water is conscious. Air is conscious. Fire is conscious. So this consciousness permeates throughout. And that is the philosophy of Sarvodaya. Sarvodaya says that life is not just human life limited to, or some people don't even believe that animals have life, or animals have soul, or animals have spirit, or animals have consciousness. Never mind, trees and mountains and the rivers have consciousness and a soul and a spirit. But the Mahatma Gandhi believed that nature had consciousness, nature had imagination, nature had a spirit and a soul. So that's a kind of all-inclusive philosophy that Mahatma Gandhi presented through one word, Sarvodaya.
Oh, so beautiful. Wow. You know, our native indigenous cultures, I've been doing stuff with people in indigenous people in Australia. I mean, they go back further than anybody, I think. And what, you know, they live this Sarvodaya. They live it to this day. And they do, you know, that still exists in tribes here in the West, in America, Canada, and so on. And we're not paying attention the way that we need to pay attention. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Yeah. We somehow, in our arrogance, have to believe that we are making progress and development. And all our ancestors were backward. They were uneducated. They were kind of savage. We use very negative terms to describe the indigenous cultures of Aboriginal people in Australia, and also the Indians in North America and South America, and the kind of indigenous people, Adivasis, in India and China and Europe. Yeah. So we kind of disparage and the kind of look down on them. But I, and Mahatma Gandhi, I learned from him, Mahatma Gandhi respected the indigenous cultures. And they said, they are our ancestors, and we have to pay tribute to them, and we have to learn from their wisdom. The Aboriginal people and indigenous people lived in harmony with the earth for millions of years. But our industrial and a more kind of progressive and more developed modern culture, in the last 200-300 years, we have been a ruin of it. We have polluted our air, we have polluted our oceans, we have polluted our atmosphere, and so on. So what are we doing? So we, in the name of progress and development and education, we are ruining the world. But our indigenous cultures and Aboriginal cultures, they lived in harmony. They lived frugally. They lived simply. And they respected nature. And they say, it's a Mother Earth. We have to look after it. Father Sky, we have to look after it. So that's the kind of wisdom of Mahatma Gandhi and the wisdom of indigenous cultures that we have to embrace if we want to have a sustainable life. And for millions and millions of years to come, we have to have a future generation in our consciousness. So they are going to live here. If they will inherit this planet, which is polluted and damaged and a kind of contaminated, what kind of earth they will inherit from us? We inherited from our indigenous people a beautiful earth, and we have spoiled it. Now I think we need to clean it so that our next generation and our future generation can inherit a beautiful earth from us. That should be our gift.
Yep. Very difficult, though. Very difficult in so many different ways. I want to end this podcast, and this everybody will get a kick out of, I think. I noticed, you know, somebody who was despairing in the way that I just mentioned, that is very difficult, and certainly we have to deal with despair. Trungpa Rinpoche, a great Tibetan Lama, said, in dealing with despair. This is just something that happened. I did a podcast recently, and in it, oh, this is from Ram Dass, pointing. Trungpa said, working with despair is working between hope and hopelessness.
Yes.
Right? And it was such a great thing. All right, but here's the quote. And it's from Jimi Hendrix, okay?
Okay.
Who so wisely said, when the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will know peace. Ram Ram, I mean, really, right?
That's absolutely true. We should all seek power of love and not love of power.
Yeah, yeah. We have to have that quote, everybody. You guys who do the show notes and all of that, we want that quote up there, okay? Because I think it emblemizes a lot of what we were talking about. Thank you so much, Satish Ji. I mean, this has been a delight for me, particularly, I mean, there's no particular, but I love the connectivity with Mahatma Gandhi. When I first went to India, Maharaji sent us up to a place called Kosani up in the Kumaon area.
Yes, and yes.
A few hours away. And we write
Lakshmi Ashram?
Yeah. You know, it's where Gandhi wrote one of his books. There's a library there still.
That's right. That's the Ashram in Kosani. Very beautiful Gandhi Ashram.
Yeah, right in front of the Trishul and those beautiful Himalayas in that area.
Yes, yes.
So it's very meaningful to me, and of course, and to Ram Dass, who really related to us many of the core values. And I'm so glad you were able to express Sardavoya. It's been wonderful being here with you. And everybody, we will have in the show notes, of course, links to the book, Radical Love, and links to some of the Gandhi material that we've been talking about. I'm sure our people will research that and give everybody a connectivity to him in particular and your work. And boy, oh boy, somehow I just want to say, let's do it again.
Thank you. Thank you, Raghu. It has been a great pleasure to speak with you and being interviewed by you. It has been, your questions have been absolutely marvelous. And my great tribute to all the great teachers, such as Ram Dass, Neem Karoli Baba, Mahatma Gandhi, and many, many others. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next week on Mind Rolling on GoToBeHereNowNetwork.com and just luxuriate in the many different teachers and presenters and podcasters. And we'll see you then.